right, Mr. Gerhardsen, Otter Tail rests.
Otter Tail rests.
Mr. Sevico, you may proceed with your opening statement.
Thank you, Your Honor, Chairman and Commissioners. As I stated previously, I'm representing the large industrial group in this matter, and I want to say that we appreciate the commissions giving us this opportunity to participate. We appreciate the company's hard work in arriving at a settlement here, as well as staff's thorough evaluation of this case and working with us. What I am planning on doing today is giving a high overview of the issues that the LIG group provided pre-filed testimony on, and offering our witnesses who are on the telephone with us today to answer any questions that you may have. And I should say on the record that with respect to the changes to the settlement agreement that were walked through by the company today, on behalf of my clients, we are in agreement with those changes. So we've got two witnesses that filed pre-filed testimony in this case. They are Larry Shadeen, and a licensed engineer, as well as Kavita Maney. With respect to Mr. Shadeen's testimony, we provided evidence and comment on the wholesale margins, which included the ancillary services margins, the FCA, various issues related to the FCA and reporting of that, some issues with respect to recovery and perceived over-recovery of results resulting or arriving at through the implementation of interim rates, some concerns with respect to the FAS 106 accounting transactions, the class cost of service study, and then some issues with respect to the general rules and regulations. With respect to those issues, as well as some of the issues raised by Ms. Maney, some of them we, through discovery, obtained further information and were satisfied with respect to our concerns, and which is why we entered into the settlement agreement, which may not have addressed all of those issues in the agreement. Now, with respect to Ms. Maney's testimony, she hit on two main issues, several issues relating to the Renewable Resource Recovery Rider, as well as the issues on behalf of our clients on rate design. Now, we have offered, I will represent to you that I have given to the judge pre-filed testimony marked as Exhibit 6, which is the pre-filed direct testimony of Larry Shadeen. At this time, I would offer that as Exhibit 6.
Mr. Gerhardsen?
No objection.
Ms. Bendish?
No objection.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No objection.
Exhibit 6 is received.
I have also given to the court for the record the direct testimony of Ms. Kavita Maney, public version marked as Exhibit 7, and I offer that.
Mr. Gerhardsen?
No objection.
Ms. Bendish?
No objection.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No objection.
Exhibit 7 is received.
Finally, I have given to the court what is marked as Exhibit 8. It is the trade secret version of direct testimony by Kavita Maney, and I offer that for the record.
Mr. Gerhardsen?
No objection.
Ms. Bendish?
No objection.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco? Exhibit 8 is received.
With that, I offer Larry Shadeen and Kavita Maney for any questions that the commissioners have.
Mr. Gerhardsen, any questions of either Mr. Shadeen or Ms. Ms. Zambani?
None at this time.
Ms. Bendish?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sack?
No.
Questions from the commission for either of the witnesses? All right. Then thank you very much, Mr. Sevico.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Take it the large industrial users rest.
We do, Your Honor.
Ms. Bendish?
I will call Michael Diller.
Well, I can't recall your previous testimony, Mr. Diller, so I should maybe administer the oath twice.
I heard all the others. I can just say that I promised to tell the truth, but if you want to go through it.
Well, the drill is that your testimony is required to be under oath, as you have previously heard, and I am required by law to advise you regarding perjury before administering the oath. Perjury is a false statement of material fact which you do not believe to be true. In other words, generally speaking, you lie. North Dakota perjury is a Class C felony, punishable by a fine up to $5,000 imprisonment for a period of up to 5 years. Being advised regarding perjury, Mr. Diller, do you swear that the testimony which you're about to give in this matter shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes.
Ms. Bendish?
Mr. Diller, can you please state your employer and your occupation?
I work for the North Dakota Public Service Commission, and I am their Director of Economic Regulation.
And can you please give us a brief description of your educational background?
Oklahoma Christian College a long time ago, and I got a degree in accounting, BS in accounting. I'm also a certified public accountant, which requires some additional 40 hours of continuing education each year.
Can you give us a brief description of your professional background?
Mostly, I've worked for this commission for almost 22 years. Before that, I worked for the Oklahoma Corporation Commission as one of their auditors for about 3 or 4 years. Before that, a Big Eight accounting firm, which kind of dates me a little bit since there's, I think, only a Big Four now. And prior to that, a tax partnership.
And did you represent the commission advocacy staff in the settlement agreement?
Yes.
You were present when the changes to Exhibit 2 were discussed, correct?
I was, but I was finishing up my planned testimony while that was going on, so you may need to refresh my memory.
I don't have the changes in front of me, but my main question was whether or not you agreed with those changes.
I don't disagree with the changes.
Would you be more comfortable if I had Mr. Gerhardsen and briefly summarize
sure.
those again for you?
Agree.
If that's appropriate, Your Honor.
It is in the circumstances.
Showing you Exhibit 2 of the settlement agreement, page 4 of 21, there's a change at the top of that page where we change the particular rate case number and intervene with that change.
I am.
The next change is on page 7. It's a minor change. It's only a case number difference. It actually is a reference to the rate case.
Yes.
Then there are two changes to rate designs that are reflected in the agreement, one on page 10 and one on page 11.
No, I brought it to the company's attention this morning for this.
And finally, we discussed some changes that were required because the expected implementation date of final rates was released in 1. There's not no reason to disagree with changes that would be required to facilitate a later implementation.
I am not.
Ms. Bendish?
Mr. Driller, you were also present when we introduced Exhibit 5 into the record, which was the memorandum and sort of settlement agreement, correct?
Yes.
Can you briefly summarize staff's position regarding the settlement in that memorandum?
You know, I wrote about 5 or 6 pages of testimony last night while I was watching the football game, and I wonder if the commissioners are maybe comfortable at this point. I am the last witness. If they're comfortable and they don't need me to go through a lot of details, I won't. Otherwise, I can certainly present the thoughts that I had last night. It doesn't matter to me.
Counsel, it's your witness.
Go ahead and summarize.
I guess if you could give a brief summary, my main question would be to you, is it staff's opinion that the settlement is fair and reasonable?
Yes, we wouldn't agree to it if we didn't think it was fair and reasonable. Did we get everything we want? No. I don't think any of the parties did, but I think it was a fair and reasonable settlement.
I would tender Mr. Diller for cross-examination.
I hesitate, counsel, just a bit as to whether this testimony meets the need of a public hearing. I don't want to waste the commission's time, but I wonder if perhaps, and I don't want you to read 5 pages. I don't think that's necessary either, but I wonder if, on the assumption that the members of the public may be listening to this hearing, whether they would be better served and perhaps interested in the commission's view of the provisions of the settlement agreement. Yes, it's your turn.
I think you raise a great point, and I did spend a few hours doing this, so I would be glad to share that.
Please do.
I think that'd be nice. Before I start, as I was talking to Judge Wall before the hearing even started, I feel a little awkward having, because this has been kind of off my radar screen for a couple of months, and maybe it's no different for anyone else. So I don't really feel, you know, fresh from the fight, have all the information rolling around in my brain like I might have if this had occurred earlier. But here are my thoughts. The memorandum in support of agreement, it was worked on by all 3 parties. We filed it. Staff didn't develop that all by itself. It was much a collaborative effort, as was the settlement agreement. And saying that, I want to make clear that it's a secondary document. It doesn't change anything in the settlement agreement, but it's supposed to. It was intended to give the commissioners and the public, as you say, a little bit of a window into the rationale and thoughts of the parties as to why to settle. And then the memorandum laid out some groundwork for addressing issues in the next rate case. And I doubt it'll be 25 years like this last go around. But Bruce laid that out, and so I don't need to cover those 4 issues again here. But it's on page 9 of the settlement. Memorandum of settlement. Okay, the first half of the memorandum is predominantly about revenue requirements, and the second half's more or less about rate design. I'll say up front, because I'm under oath and I'll tell the truth, that right off the bat, staff was under the impression that revenue requirements really wasn't the main issue here. You know, it almost seemed preposterous to me that a utility company, a capital-intensive industry, could stay out of the commission for 25 years and not require a rate increase. So right away I thought a 5% increase after 25 years seems pretty reasonable, and staff has a little bit of a challenge here if we want to eliminate that. But I want to be clear that Otter Tail's base rates, while they haven't had a base rate increase in 25 years, the cost of fuel has risen, and the impact of that is has been felt by ratepayers, and we received that complaint as from some of their customers that call into the commission and want to let us know about what they think about that fuel clause adjustment going up. So I want to give Otter Tail credit, but maybe not as much credit as they want to give themselves. On the other hand, it was equally clear to staff that rate design was where it was at. Rate design was so out of kilter that it looked like it was going to be a serious challenge to come up with a reasonable solution. For instance, some of Otter Tail's rate classes have not been subject to the monthly fuel clause adjustment, and as a result, those customers that have not been subject to the fuel clause adjustment for the last 25 years are enjoying base rates built on 1982 energy prices. And so instances like that, with this amount of time transpiring, it creates quite a, well, it's almost an unworkable rate design problem. Because no matter how you try, there's going to remain some subsidy issues. And I know Jerry doesn't like me to use the word subsidies, but I'm not a rate design expert, so I'm going to go ahead and use them. With regard to the revenue requirements, then, as the commission may require, staff initiated a partial settlement negotiation, which Bruce talked about a little bit earlier, very early in the process to explore the possibility of agreeing to a reasonable rate of return, reasonable cost of capital to use in revenue requirement calculations. A partial settlement agreement on cost of capital was reached, and part of that was a profit-sharing agreement, so that if the company, after rates increases are granted, if they're granted by the commission, after that, if earnings go above 10.75%, then the customers will get half of the profits above 10.75%. 75% will go to the customers if the company earns above 11.25%. In my mind, this early settlement agreement allowed staff to spend their resources, and the companies in the large industrial group, spend their resources on what I'd call more concrete issues, and minimize some of the risk inherent in arguing or fighting about rate of return and establishing new base rates. The biggest difference between staff's pre-filed testimony and the settlement agreement pertains to depreciation expense. I know two commissioners were at that hearing, and you probably recall a large portion of staff's testimony about the imputation of inflation in Otter Tail's cost of removal estimates. I'll just say from a depreciation standpoint right now that depreciation expense is always a pay me now or pay me later proposition. In the end, and theoretically speaking, customers as a whole never pay, they don't pay for more than 100%. They don't pay for more or less. And that includes allowances for cost of removal. That's part of the total investment, the total package that's amortized out. Staff's testimony made an argument of intergenerational ratepayer inequities, if you remember that, and essentially arguing that ratepayers today pay more for future removal costs than do future ratepayers due to the time value of money. While staff's position, I think, was theoretically sound, the record in the proceeding, if you remember, I think indicated that was a little bit out of the box for traditional rate making ideas and thoughts. Given the long time between the rate cases, in my mind, the softness of the capital markets, and even the regulatory compact that I feel exists between financial institutes and the regulatory bodies, I just felt like that was an issue that even if we won, we might lose in the long run. And so That's why I was willing to give up on that, our largest adjustment, really. Staff made other concessions with regard to revenue requirements, and I wouldn't even call these concessions, I guess, but we, through the process, we discovered that we made some errors, and errors, of course, lead to bad conclusions, and so we obviously had to give those up, but and we gave up on a few that I thought were likely to be lost in any kind of a litigated decision by the commission. Okay, with regard to rate design, Jerry Lean's was our primary negotiator and our true expert. I'll give you my $40,000 foot view as the manager of the rate case. And if that's not enough, Jerry would love to get up here and testify about rate design further. As I said before, rate design appeared to be our biggest challenge. Achieving consensus on rate design required so much more work than the revenue requirement portion. Otter Tail's class customer cost of service study indicated, and I'm going to read this paragraph because I want to get it right, that if rates were designed to cover each class's share of embedded costs, rate changes would range between a rate decrease of 8% for general service customers and a 75% increase in irrigation rates. Our staff, consultant Charlie King, made some adjustments to Otter Tail's class cost of service study, but in the end, it did little to change the disparity we noticed between classes. In fact, in his analysis, when he was all done making his adjustments, which tended to move costs, shift costs away from the residential customer, the deficiencies ranging within the customer classes was a 12% decrease for general service customers and a 78% increase in irrigation rates. So whichever you look at, however you cut it, there are a lot of, I'll call it rate inequities using the two class cost of service studies that I'm familiar with. In the past, the staff's used the Jerry Lean rule of thumb, and I don't know where he got it, but for addressing inter-class deficiencies or sufficiencies, depending on which class of customer you are, in their portion of contributions to revenue requirements. Staff's generally argued that any given customer class should not receive a rate increase of more than twice what the overall increase. In this case, we're settling for 3%. So as a general rule of thumb, we wouldn't advocate increasing any of the other customer classes by more than 6%. On the other side, we would not advocate normally that any customer class would get away without paying something. In fact, Jerry's rule of thumb has been half of what the overall general rate increase. So that would mean 1.5%. So that would be normally staff's range of adjusting customer classes between, in this case, 1.5% and 6%. You will notice in the settlement agreement that we went quite far and beyond that. But let me just, the four that really jump out at you. First of all, you'll notice that the large general service customers are not getting any rate increase here, zero, which is 1.5% lower than Jerry's, than staff's normal rule of thumb. I have to say this, that as unbiased as we like to pretend that we are, we've been, staff's been affected a little bit with some of the goings on in the marketplace. Imation, for a very good example. We tend to believe that that this particular class of customers is subject to global competition like none of the other customer classes are. And in a soft market, you really don't want to be messing around with the price of energy for these customers. That's, in addition to that, as I've indicated already, this particular class of customer generally subsidizes, for lack of a better word, the rest of the customer classes. And so for that reason, we abandoned our rule. Some of it had to do with, I think I'll stop there. With regard to the other three classes that jump out at you, lighting, we have an 18% increase scheduled in the settlement agreement. An 11% increase for other public authority, the other public authority customer class, which is primarily pumping charges, and also the controlled service interruptible class with a 19% interest. 19% increase, I'm sorry. With regard to those customers, those are the customers that a fuel clause adjustment hasn't been applicable to, hasn't been applied to. And so naturally, there's going to be a large increase that occurs in rate design when all of a sudden those customers are brought up, so to speak, into the year 2009. So that's the 40,000 foot view of rate design from my perspective, and that concludes my summary.
Anything further, Ms. Bendish?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Gerhardsen?
No questions, Your Honor.
Mr. Savickle?
None, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle? Thank you very much, Mr. Dillon. I'm sorry. Questions from the commission?
Just.
Commissioner
quickly.
Clark.
Mike, on that table three that you were walking us through on the different customer classes, the controlled service interruptible, is that the irrigation rate?
Are you looking at the memorandum in support?
I'm looking at the actual settlement on page 9. I'm sure it doesn't say irrigation, but when we talk about irrigators, I'm assuming that that's where they're falling under, is that controlled service interruptible rate?
No, irrigation's line 6.
Oh, it is a separate class. Okay.
Yep.
Thanks. And when you said the that the fuel clause was not applying, is that to both the class 8 and class 10?
8, 6, 7, and 8.
Okay, thanks.
Any further questions from the Commissioner Kramer?
Mike, when you talk about referencing the recession as a reason to not or to allow 0% zero increase in large general services rates and to try and keep Otter Tail ratepayers at least or Otter Tail territory globally competitive, and we heard earlier testimony and noticing the stipulation that. Of the $450,000 for economic development investments to be recovered. And this is kind of a general policy question, I guess, but since the topic was raised, should we be looking at more economic developments type of rates in rate design as opposed to having industry-subsidized residential? Do we have that upside down, or do we run a risk of having a whole bunch of ratepayers without jobs?
Start with that. I would just say that I was around when this economic development fund that was addressed earlier was implemented. In fact, I happened to be the person, and I know this will maybe cause some of you to cringe, but I was one of the persons that I may have been the person to suggest it, and that was back in the days when John Erickson was head of the rate department. But And it gave me a lot of cause for alarm. I wasn't sure that I really wanted what I was about to get, it looked like. And I didn't, actually when I proposed it, I didn't think we'd ever get it by the commission. We had a hawk on the commission at that time who now sits down in the Supreme Court. And I would have bet the House that would have never made it through like it did. I'll cut to the chase. My thinking on economic development, this economic development fund is this. Otter Tail serves very, very rural communities, unlike any other utility probably in the country, other than maybe co-ops, I suppose. But as such, they don't really have the economic development, I'll just call it infrastructure or things that maybe bigger cities have. They have their own, but I just for me, the utility company and a lot of these little smaller towns, smaller communities is the player, and it just seemed like that. As stingy as I am about sharing ratepayer money with charitable contributions or economic development, this seemed like this was different. That this one could make a difference, and it could even pay for itself. We've had lots of presentations from the company that indicates that it does more or less pay for itself, but then Tom got up and explained that that's soft science, so it is what it is. Now, I didn't get around to your question of should we have economic development rates? Without thinking about it much, I would be hesitant to go that route. And I know I'll be caught a little bit in a trap here from what I've just said, but in my mind, we want to develop rates that are based on true cost. The closer we can get to true cost, the better price signals we send to everyone, and then everyone can make informed decisions of how to best use all the resources that they have at their disposal. And so I actually kind of appreciate the large industrial group kind of pressed on for considering this E8760 allocator in the next rate case. We don't have to talk about what that means, but it's an attempt on their part to move costs to reflect a truer cost, a better cost. And I really don't think Commissioner Kramer, I don't think I'm an advocate, having only thought about it for a couple of minutes here, I don't think I'm an advocate of economic development rates, per se.
Any further questions from the commission? Commissioner Clark.
Just quickly to clarify, you said on the classes it did not have a fuel clause. You said 6, 7, 8. 10 does have the fuel clause included?
No, okay. 10.
So it's 6, 7, 8, 10?
I believe that's correct. Let me get a head nod. That's my answer.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions from the commission? Follow up, Mr. Gerhardsen?
None.
Mr. Savico?
None.
Ms. Bendish, you get another round, too. Any follow up on your part?
None for Mr.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco. All right. Now, Mr. Dillon, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for letting me share.
Yeah, thanks for not robbing us of that pleasure.
All right. Ms. Bendish, I assume you rest.
I do, Your Honor. The only thing I would offer, which I believe would be Exhibit 9 and 10, is the direct testimony of Charles King and Michael Manjaros, Jr.
Any particular order?
No.
All right. Then I, as it happens, I have the direct testimony of Mr. Majoris on the top. That will be Exhibit 9. Mr. Gerhardsen? Mr. Savico?
None, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco? Exhibit 9 is received. Exhibit 10. Is the direct testimony of Charles W. King. Mr. Gerhardsen? Mr. Savico?
None.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco? Exhibit 10 is received. Now, these proceedings are a bit irregular, but let's do the drill. Any rebuttal, Mr. Gerhardsen?
No rebuttal.
Rebuttal, Mr. Savico?
No rebuttal, Your Honor.
Rebuttal, Ms. Bendish? All right. Then closing statements, counsel, Mr. Gerhardsen.
Your Honor, if I might, just before we go to opening statement, I wonder if I may just clarify on the record that Exhibit 1 actually contains the testimony of Otter Tail witnesses, the pre-filed direct testimony of Otter Tail witnesses. We're not offering that separately since it is contained within that exhibit, and don't think it should be unless anyone else has objection with proceeding on that basis.
They're a little late with their objection.
Thank you. I think that then for a closing statement, I would just say thank you to the commission, Your Honor, staff, and interveners. It's been a while. We've been working on this a long time. It was a long time since the last one. In fact, almost no one involved in this rate case proceeding had any rate case experience. I'm proud of our company for that fact. I'm also proud of our company for the fact that we had what I think was a good rate case, and we had very good cooperation and heated but civil negotiations with our counterparties within the advocacy staff and with the LIG, and for them, for those negotiations, I thank those folks. I think that the cases contained now within the settlement, and I guess we'd request that it be approved by the commission, if possible, by the November 1st date that Mr. Brous mentioned. I do recognize that may not be possible administratively. If that isn't possible, then we'd shoot for the first of the following month. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Savicol, it's a little hard to imagine a rebuttal in these circumstances, but I'll ask, since that's what the rules provide, and otherwise your closing statement, if any.
No rebuttal, and I would like to mirror Mr. Gerhardsen's comments. We appreciate the commission as well as all the parties, and urge the commission to act as fast as possible, as we are paying interim rates, and they will be adjusted. Thank you.
Bendish.
I have nothing for you, Your Honor.
Closing by the commission. Commissioner Kramer.
Just thank you to everyone.
Commissioner Clark.
Well, thanks to everyone for the discussion today. This has been helpful. I'll just offer a couple of comments and not bind myself to any of them, understanding that we have a work session where we'll be discussing. One of the things that occurs to me is that this might be an example of why it may not be a wise thing to have 25 years between rate cases, even if there are not specifically rate increase issues that come up. It might make sense for the commission to learn from this and, at the very least, perhaps talk about rate design or interim rate design adjustments throughout the course of those 25 years, even if there isn't a rate of return issue that we need to address, just because I do think that, as Mr. Diller observed, that every year you get a little bit further out of whack when it comes to rate design and discrepancies between the classes. As with any settlement, there are things that as commissioners, just as parties, you like and don't like. I like the fact that we're at least moving towards trying to address some of these inconsistencies amongst the classes, and to the degree that we can move towards more cost-based rates and more towards getting fixed costs through fixed charges and variable costs through variable charges. I think that's good, even if it doesn't accomplish the entire goal. I'll be honest, the economic development thing has for some time caused me some heartburn, both in discussions with the company and in pondering this particular rate case. I think it's an issue that utilities need to be very, very careful with, not to draw analogies too close, but we've seen it recently with a quasi-utility in the state on the health insurance front, where this particular issue did come up, where you take ratepayer dollars and apply them to economic development types of activities. It's something that I think utilities need to be very, very careful with. It's something that, as a general philosophical point, I would ask everyone to consider strongly in the future whether this is, in fact, part of the core mission of what public utilities do, and that there is, as some of the witnesses suggested, perhaps some soft science to how we calculate the benefits of it. So those are just a couple of closing thoughts, and as I said, we'll have a chance to discuss that a little bit more over the next few weeks. But again, appreciate all the information on the record.
Commissioner Cook.
Just, you know, as being the third guy, all the good stuff always goes, right? Yeah. But the I'm very comfortable with everything I heard today, 99% comfort level. I really do appreciate the work that all of you do put into this because it is very important. And it's always nice to see the community get involved through large industrial group because you bring a layer of scrutiny to this that helps us do what we do. So I'm comfortable with what I heard today, but I will just throw out there as just the next step. I'm very uncomfortable right now with the rules that are coming out of the federal government for energy development and how you're going to do your job and we're going to do our job, not knowing what the rules are 15 or 20 years down the road. So I would look forward to, I don't know who the best person is, but coming back to us and giving us a full layout of, okay, we aren't in Big Stone 2 now. How are you going to meet your demands? What are the things you're going to be looking at? Because these are two separate issues. I'm moving on. But they really are. We've got to do this right in the next, you know, we always got to do it right, but especially now in the next 2-3 years, we're not going to be putting the infrastructure in place that meets the demand down the road. So I'll get off my soapbox now. But I think that's that we cannot – we have to be talking all the time on all these issues, and really what Tony said, too, is don't wait another 25 years to come back here because the three of us won't be in the Supreme Court by then, I'll guarantee you that. But we might still be here. Who knows? So thank you very much.
Thank you, commissioners. Thank you, counsel. The hearing is closed.
Unless you're interested in the Supreme Court.
No.